It's the week in review on the Joy Cardine Show. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the IDES Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Each week at this time, we take a look at the week's top news stories from a couple of different perspectives, and we'll get yours as well at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or find us on social media. The Joy Cardine Show has a Facebook page and a Twitter account. Let's introduce our guests for this week's Week in Review. Paul DeMaine is the Chief Executive Officer of Indian Country Communications and Editor of News from Indian Country. Paul, hello. Welcome to the Week in Review.
Good morning.
And Rick Essenberg is an Adjunct Professor of Law at Marquette University, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and a blogger at sharkandshepherd.blogspot.com. Rick Essenberg, welcome back to the Week in Review as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
State Republicans on the Joint Committee on Finance plan on eliminating the alternative minimum income tax, which pretty much benefits people making more than $200,000 a year. The loss of revenue would be offset by raising taxes elsewhere, so there would be no net reduction in tax collections. Representative Dale Coenga says the main motivation there is to simplify the state's tax code. Rick Essenberg, let's start with you. Is this a good or bad idea, and why?
Well, it's probably a good idea. I mean, Dale Coenga is a CPA. He's really one of the smartest guys in the legislature. And the alternative minimum tax is, you know, what they call in the computer world a kludge. It's something which is laid on top of the tax system in order to fix things that probably shouldn't be there. And what Dale has been advocating for the last couple of years is that we broaden the base and simplify the system, that we take out a lot of the credits and the deductions, which we really don't need. And when we do that, we don't need the AMT. What happened with the AMT is that because the rate structure changed in the last budget, it winds up hitting not people at the very top of the income range, but sort of upper middle class people, because their marginal tax rates and the marginal tax rates of those below them were reduced below the AMT rate. And that was really an unintended consequence of the structure change, and it makes some sense to fix it. It's not a lot of money one way or the other in terms of the state budget.
Democratic State Representative Chris Taylor, who serves on Joint Finance, said taxes shouldn't be cut for the wealthy while the University of Wisconsin faces a budget cut and funding for K-12 schools is not going up. Paul DeMaine, do you agree with Representative Taylor?
Well, I do in a certain sense. I think that the taxing structure needs to be looked at because, indeed, there's a lot of credits and deductions and things that ought to be eliminated. There ought to be a simplification of it. But you always, at least in the last few years, I've got to question this whole idea that somehow these taxes, whether they're the estate taxes or whether the minimum tax policies here that we're looking at, the eliminating the alternative minimum income tax, is something that is really going to be a positive impact. For example, they're saying what the upper middle class, I'd like to see the definition of what the upper middle class is, because a lot of these policies have continued to support the wealthy at a time when the wealthy probably don't need any more assistance. They're certainly not suffering. The accumulation of wealth in that top 1%, when over 50% of the population below it doesn't have as much wealth as that 1%, is odd. So in order to look at this entire thing, I'd like to see what the other end of it is, because when they say, well, you got to broaden the base usually is at the bottom, and that seems to be who has been picking up the tax liabilities more and more often, is the middle class rather than the wealthy.
We have a comment from Marsha on Facebook who writes, you want to simplify the tax code? Go to a flat tax, even if it's just on the state level. Is a flat tax a better way to go, as Marsha maintains? Paul, you first and then Rick.
Well, I've looked at the flat tax previously, and it's so broad that it's going to be a difficult point The question seems to be is where do you start to change that proposal of the flat tax? So I guess I'd be in favor of looking at how that would work and where the shift would begin, because for a huge comprehensive overhaul in the flat tax is going to take quite a bit of work.
And Rick Essenberg?
Well, you know, Wisconsin, at least compared to federal rates, has a relatively flat income tax. The rates vary between something around 5% and something around 7%. I think it makes sense. I don't choose to talk about this in terms of the idea that lowering somebody's tax rate and letting them keep the money that they earned is assisting them in some way. I think the presumption ought to be that people are entitled to the money they make, not that government has the first claim on it, and that any mercy that we show them with respect to the imposition of taxes somehow ought to be called assistance. I just don't see it that way.
We also got a number of Facebook comments from people saying we should be raising taxes on the rich. Rick Essenberg, what would that do to the state's economy, do you think?
Well, you know, the problem is that people aren't captive in Wisconsin. I mean, they can go other places. And, you know, we can argue back and forth about different policies, but if you look at where jobs are being created, like states like Texas and North Dakota, the evidence is really overwhelming that jobs are being created in red states, right? States that generally follow low tax, low expenditure policies. And no matter what you think of what Scott Walker has done over the last 5 years in this state, we are still a high tax state. We are still a state that spends more than average. We are still a state that taxes more than average, while we are a state whose income is below average. And so that strategy isn't working for us. And I think that to simply say, you know, we're going to raise taxes without regard to what that's going to do to the formation of capital, to innovation in the state, particularly when you're talking about raising taxes on people who, well, quite frankly, can leave. They don't have to stay here. And I think that type of approach is unlikely to yield the kind of benefits that the people who advocate it think it will.
Paul DeMaine?
Well, the thing is that if you look at what's going on in Minnesota, a state where they did raise the taxes on the rich and have created more jobs than the state of Wisconsin under Walker, and have been able to fund some initiatives in education that'll be an investment in the future, I think that you can find that there's a balancing act on either side. I don't think the proof is in the pudding in Wisconsin. We're lagging throughout the Great Lakes. We're lagging throughout the United States in terms of job development. And we've seen this massive reduction in the investment into the future in our educational project as a way to cut this, cut this, cut that, give more money to the wealthy people so they can stay here. Frankly, a lot of the wealthy people they have the option to go anywhere they want. People are coming to certain areas because they like the basic geography and the atmosphere and everything, and I think that there are wealthy people who would be happy to pay their fair taxes or more if they could get good roads and good education and good government out of it.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he wants to see a borrowing cut for state highway projects by at least $800 million. That would delay a number of transportation projects, including the Zoo Interchange in Milwaukee and the Stillwater Bridge in western Wisconsin. Governor Walker had asked for $1.3 billion for roads and has ruled out taxes or fee hikes. Paul DeMaine, what would you like to see done about our transportation situation?
Well, here's a political party who just demeans the president and the politicians in Washington, D.C. for deficit spending and borrowing off the backs of future generations. And yet when it comes to their opportunity, they're proposing borrowing billions of dollars again. This is another budget. It's not the first time they've been doing the last couple budgets. And so it would seem to me that those people who utilize the roads ought to be responsible for paying for them. If it means raising the taxes, despite the fact that Walker basically wants to be able to get away with saying he's not raising taxes on anything through this segment, so he can make that a part of his presidential bid, I think that this is going to be some tough decisions. And the tough decisions mean that we ought not borrow that money. We've already indebted the transportation fund in the state of Wisconsin, the taxpayers, to $1 billion of bonds and borrowing already. We need to get down and find something that says, look, if the users of these highways ought to pay either a higher tax or a higher levy on their license or whatever it is, they need to fund it if they want to drive on good roads. I understand that this it may mean that some of these huge interstate projects are going to be delayed, but that's going to have to be the way it is if the money isn't there. But this legislature has an opportunity to find the money.
Rick Essenberg, a tough spot for the state legislature to be in with road projects sitting out there waiting to be done. And how do we finance them? What's your take on this?
Well, you know, it is a tough spot, but, you know, I always like to step back and sort of take a longer look at things rather than simply focus on what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, I mean, we can talk about Minnesota, but Wisconsin is pretty much just like Minnesota. It is a high-tax, high-spending state with, actually unlike Minnesota, with below-average income. And If you look at what's happened over the past 20 years or so, we haven't slashed spending on public education. Public education per pupil in real terms is up, even after Act 11. But we have seen a shift away from what the state government spends its money on. And it spends its money, it has less money to spend on infrastructure because it spends more money on entitlements. In part, that's because of Medicaid expansion and impositions which, you know, have either been imposed on us by the federal government or that we've allowed the federal government to bribe us into through categorical grants and aids. And so we have, it's tougher to do things that really are the first task of government, like paying for roads. And it's one thing to say that, well, you know, we ought to just increase the gas tax, but that's a regressive tax, and it's not clear to me that's the only answer. And it's a tough question, but it's a tough question because of long-term shifts in what we spend our money on, not because we're spending less than and we're taxing less than we spent in the past.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel also reported on a $500 million compromise cut, which would delay all the big projects in southeastern Wisconsin except for the zoo interchange. Rick Essenberg, that's your part of the state. How important do you think it is to make sure that the zoo interchange project gets done in a timely fashion?
Well, it's critical. Now, I might think it's critical because I've spent a lot of time stuck in my car at the zoo interchange, although happily for me, I live north of the city of Milwaukee and not west of it. But it's also the thing that people don't focus on. It's really critical for economic development. A lot of the use of that zoo interchange is commercial. And, you know, businesses along the Milwaukee-Madison corridor need to have that road system available in order to ship goods out, to bring supplies in. And right now it's simply unacceptable. It's too congested. It's not particularly safe. The project has been delayed too long. It really is something that needs to get done. As I said before, it really is. You know, these are the first tasks of government to provide, you know, police and fire protection, to provide for public roads. And I think we, somehow we need to find a way to get it done.
We're going to talk about the latest transportation talks with a couple of state lawmakers during Monday morning's state capitol report starting at 7 o'clock. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more with our guests, Paul DeMaine and Rick Essenberg, on The Week in Review. Still to come, we're going to talk about an opinion piece Governor Walker wrote this week touting his reforms to education and why he says they should be a model for the nation. And we'll talk about a proposal to do away with the Legislative Audit Bureau. All that coming up on The Week in Review. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Mm-hmm. It's the Week in Review on the Joy Cardine Show here on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. My guests on this week's edition of the Week in Review are Paul Demain, Chief Executive Officer of Indian Country Communications and Editor of News from Indian Country, and Rick Essenberg, Adjunct Professor of Law at Marquette University, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and a blogger at sharkandshepherd.blogspot.com. The Joint Finance Committee may also take up the Milwaukee Bucks arena deal next week. Rick Essenberg, what would you like to see done there?
I don't know. I mean, you know, on the one hand, I have, it's very hard for me to overcome my principled objection that the government ought not really be handing out a bunch of money to a private business in this way. On the other hand, the state is sort of in a pickle because it's on the hook for maintenance costs at the Bradley Center should the Bucks leave, and there won't be any revenue to cover that. And the state collects a lot of tax revenue from NBA players, and they tax the income that they earn while they're playing here. And so it's expensive to do nothing. And so this may be a case where we have to depart from principle. I think that the one argument that I think makes little sense, and I wrote something about this week, is the argument that, well, these guys that own the Bucks should, you know, pay for the whole arena because they can afford it. That's true in one sense. You know, they probably could afford it, but they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it because people generally don't give money away simply because they can. And keeping the Bucks in Milwaukee is not the way to maximize the value of that team. So we're asking them to do something which will lower the value of their investment. And I think the only way that we can get them to do it is to participate in the funding of the arena. And so it may be the kind of thing that you have to hold your nose and you have to do. The deal that we have on the table now is kind of an odd thing. It's a Rube Goldberg type of contraction where money is coming from different sources, and it really has been structured, I think, in a way to satisfy sort of the political needs of the politicians at the state and the county and the city level that are trying to put it together. I don't know that there's any way around that. It may be the best deal that can be done, but it's an odd-looking deal.
Paul Demain, you're out in Hayward, which is nowhere near Milwaukee, as anyone who knows anything about the geography of Wisconsin would know. How much of an interest do you have in whether or not the Bucks stay in the Badger State or the league buys the team and moves them to Seattle? And how does that affect how you think these arena negotiations should proceed?
I think there's a general public perception throughout Wisconsin that it would be nice to hold on to the Bucks, but I also think the perception has to do with all some of the arguments that Rick has already made for me this morning, and that is simply that it's a situation where people are perceiving this as from this kind of point of view. Why is it that big government is helping the millionaires and billionaires again? Why is it always that those people seem to get the attentions, get the taxpayers' money? Here's some more socialism of people utilizing state taxpayers' money to subsidize in some way people who have the ability, and why we hear the argument that let the market define what happens with business equities and investments and those kinds of things, and yet we're going to intervene, we're going to use state taxpayers' money at a time when there is no extra money to do this to support millionaires and billionaires. Now, again, my sentiment is in the fact that we ought to put something together, and it's very convoluted because I have mixed feelings about it, just like Rick does. But when you're talking about spending that kind of money, and we're talking about saying, hey, we need to look at the long-term view of things. For example, we'll go back to the transportation just for a minute. When the trends are against extractive industries and oil transportation cars, and public transportation, when people are utilizing public transportation and bicycling more, why are we investing in these big projects? That's a long-term view. And try to tell people in the public education system that there's more money in the public school systems when we have hundreds of communities thinking about holding referendums because they've had to cut out all the auxiliary courses, less sports, less music, higher class student populations and everything. Why isn't that same kind of investment in our educational system? Why is it going to go to benefit a handful of people who have the money, who are millionaires and billionaires, have the money to invest in it if they want to do that?
Well, speaking of education,
I mean,
go ahead, Rick.
The thing, though, we have to be clear about the Bucks deal is that if we let the market decide, I mean, that team is worth far more in Seattle than it is in Milwaukee. Now, I think that the way that Herb Kohl structured this deal, Edens and Lasry cannot move the team to Seattle, but somebody can. And if you're helping them in a sense by giving them the money, but at the same time, if you give them the money, they're going to have to keep the team in Milwaukee, and they will be leaving money on the table to do that. Because if assuming that Edens and Lasry have the ability to move this team to Seattle, which I don't think they do, I think they'd have to sell the team back to the NBA, and the NBA would then sell it off to the highest bidder who would move it to Seattle. They would actually be better off if we didn't build the arena and they moved the team to Seattle. They would have an asset which is worth more than the Milwaukee Bucks with a new arena in Milwaukee. And so the thing that you have to understand about the arena deal is, yeah, we're giving money to billionaires, but we're also asking the billionaires to do something which is not in their financial interest, and that is keep the team here.
800-642-1234, the number to call to let us know which national or state political story from the past week you'd like to discuss. 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook or Twitter and leave your comment or question there. Paul Domain and Rick Essenberg are with me on this week's Week in Review. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine, who is on her way to Alaska. Cue the Johnny Horton music. Speaking of education, Governor Walker wrote an opinion column this week that appeared in the Des Moines Register. He said there's no reason changes he championed to public education in Wisconsin can't be pushed nationwide. He touted the curtailing of teacher union rights that he signed into law in 2011 and says the changes replaced a broken system in Wisconsin by doing away with protections for seniority and tenure. Paul Domain, what should the rest of the nation be learning about these education reforms?
Well, number one, maybe by tearing up the unions nationwide, getting rid of tenure, cutting the ability of funding to public school systems to hire the best teachers will prevent the flight that's going on of our teachers in the public school systems, people who've gotten out while they can, people who feel that they've been dismissed as public servants, not only in the elimination of the union, but in how the school teachers seem to have been, the whole educational system seems to be demeaned nowadays by the Republican legislature. This has always been an investment, and when we're looking at the long term, things that happened 30, 25, 20 years ago are benefiting the state of Wisconsin now. So a lot of the impacts of these budget cuts and union busting and so forth that have gone on, we're going to see the impact of that in future years as teachers have a hard time controlling their classrooms because they're so large, the quality of education goes down, the best of the teachers have left the state, university teachers are thinking about getting out because of the lack of tenure. So if that's good, maybe that nationwide policy will keep people from fleeing from one state to another for a better opportunity.
Rick Essenberg?
You know, my organization recently released a report called Diminishing Returns, and it looked at, you know, what's happened to public education in the United States and Wisconsin over the past 30 to 40 years, and the fact of the matter is this: spending on public education per pupil in real terms over the last 30, 40 years has gone up. It's gone up sharply. Student achievement has not gone up. It's remained flat. The United States pays on a per pupil basis about 30% more per student than the average in developing countries. But our performance as compared to international benchmarks is at best average. And so I start with the proposition that we've got a system which isn't working very well. Franklin Roosevelt warned us about public unions a long time ago, and if you understand the way that they work, they're a form of cartelization. They're a form of essentially the teachers band together and they try to get more bargaining power so that they can grab more of the portion which is allocated to public education, and that's happened. We have a horrible situation in Milwaukee where MPS has $2.2 billion in unfunded liabilities for pensioners' health care. It's hollowing the system out. And it makes some sense, I think, to give local school districts the tools that they need to manage their staff rationally. The idea that the only way that we can hire teachers is to have rigid certification requirements, to have tenure, virtual lifetime job protection, so it's very, very difficult to fire them no matter what they do, and to pay them in accordance with, seniority is not, self-evidently the best way to do it. And I think what's happened with Act 10 is that school districts have the opportunity, if they want to use it, to make sure that more money gets spent actually on educating kids. And districts don't have to use those tools. They can continue to, proceed rigidly as they have in the past. But at least now they've got the option.
UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank says removing tenure from state law is not the disaster that some people want to portray. She said the UW will act fast to ensure that tenure is the equivalent of its peers across the country. Rick Essenberg, do you agree with Blank that removing tenure is not the dire consequence that we've been hearing from some people?
Well, they're not removing tenure. They're removing the compulsion to have tenure from state statute. The University of Wisconsin remains free to have tenure, and I suspect it will. There are 49 other states that have public universities, and they don't have a tenure requirement statute. Private universities, such as, Marquette, Harvard, Yale, they don't have any legal compulsion to have tenure, but they still do it because the market for professors demands it. And I'm sure that the University of Wisconsin will continue to do it as well. I think down the road it may be the case that because universities are going to be under increasing cost pressures and competitive pressures, they may have to reduce the number of tenure line positions that they have, and I think this gives the university the flexibility to do it. But I don't see the University of Wisconsin eliminating tenure. I mean, I wouldn't do it if I were on the Board of Regents because I just think it would hurt recruiting. And that's why, that's why Marquette has tenure, even though Marquette is under no obligation to do it.
Rick, Paul Demain?
Right. Well, indeed, it's one more tool, and I agree that it's probably not the disaster that some people are saying, because indeed the university system itself can keep that tenure, and there's reasons to have that tenure, so there's some protections. I mean, already we have politicians calling for the firing of teachers in the university system who they don't agree with in terms of either their research or their political leanings or whatever it may be. These kinds of tools are meant to protect and insulate people from these kinds of political attacks. I know that sometimes it makes things difficult to change around, but I think those tools are still there in terms of being able to exercise the right to get rid of bad teachers and the certification standards that we think lead to a good education. I mean, we haven't seen it's not like the data on what our students are learning and has increased tremendously in the last 5 years as these budget cuts and changes have occurred. Nothing shows me that the status of the public schools and what those students are doing has risen because there's less money there for the students or there's less protection for the teachers. And at the same time, what we're seeing is this massive flow of money out of the public school system into private vouchers, where private for-profit schools are being paid tremendously more than the average amount of money the state's sending to the public school districts. For example, Hayward, Wisconsin, $320 per student because of the way the taxes are structured in this county, whereas you can get up to an $8,000 voucher, and state taxpayers' money is paying for this. And at the same time, you've had some schools that have simply pulled up stakes and left in the middle of the season. That doesn't happen in public education, but it does happen in the for-private sector.
Well, Chancellor
I'd like to address that because you know we have failing choice schools, we have failing private schools. I mean, we have choice schools in Milwaukee which have very low proficiency ratings for their students. We have public schools in Milwaukee that have the same low proficiency ratings. And it's simply not true that the voucher amount exceeds the amount that is spent per pupil on public schools in Milwaukee. So the average expenditure, the average revenue limit per school district in Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin is around $10,000. The voucher amount is around $7,000. And, you know, we're going to put out a report on the fiscal impact of a statewide voucher expansion later today. And what we've done is we've run the numbers and we've shown that the formula, as it's been proposed by the Republicans in the legislature, that for kids leaving public schools to enter the state private voucher program would actually increase the per pupil expenditure amount for those public students that remain in public schools. And that happens because the schools will be able to continue to count those departing students for purposes of revenue limit and state equalization aid. And so the idea that massive amounts of money are somehow being siphoned off to private schools, I think, is something that doesn't really withstand scrutiny.
One more take on the UW system. Chancellor Blank also said that the 10-year change, along with a $250 million cut to the UW system, is leading to other universities trying to hire away faculty from Wisconsin. Paul DeMaine, how concerned are you about UW system schools losing star faculty to other universities?
Well, I'm not really concerned about it. It's just happening. That's the way it is. There are people, like I said, the atmosphere over public education, this relentless attack on education at all levels, at the public school system, at the university system, and the investment in our future, I think has led to demoralization in which the recruitment by out-of-state universities and public and for our public school teachers is going on, and it makes sense because if you can build a career somewhere else with tenure protections or higher wages and salaries than what you're getting here in the future, you're going to go there. So it's not like I'm concerned about it. It's already happening. There are people leaving the university. And I think part of it just has to do with this relentless attack on public education that's been occurring in Wisconsin.
Rick Essenberg, are you concerned about a brain drain in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, again, I think you have to put all of these things in context. And it's hard for me to think that there's a war on public education because, you know, somebody proposed that because the budget is tight this year, we're going to reduce, and this is what it amounted to, we're going to reduce state equalization aid by 1%. I mean, that's not ideal. It would be better if we didn't have to do it, but it's hardly existential. It's not decimating. It's not slashing. It's not a war. The University of Wisconsin system between 2003 and 2013, or maybe it's 2001 and 2011, but a very recent 10-year period, its revenue for student increased from $24,000 per full-time equivalent student to $36,000. That's a 20% real increase. And so the fact now that somebody is proposing that there should be a reduction in state aid to the university, which will amount to 2.4% of its revenue, when that revenue has increased by 20% in real terms over the last 10 years, I wonder how many listeners have had a 20% real increase in their salary over the last 10 years. It's not ideal. It may be better that if we could figure out a way not to do it, but it's not a war. It's not existential. And if a university that has seen that type of increase in its revenue somehow finds it unable to pay competitive salaries, I think the question is, why not? Why not? Why haven't you been able to pay competitive salaries? Because it's certainly not because you're lacking for revenue.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we want to talk about some other issues, including a proposal in the state legislature to remove the Legislative Audit Bureau. And we'll also talk about the new chair of the state Democratic Party. And, of course, coming up, the all-important Week in Review quiz with its fabulous prizes. It's the Week in Review on the Joy Cardine Show. My guests are Paul Domain and Rick Essenberg. We'll be back with them in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. It's our Week in Review on the Joy Cardine Show. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. My guests, Paul Domain and Rick Essenberg, here to talk about the big issues of this week in the news. And one of those big issues is that there is a proposal in the State Assembly to get rid of the Legislative Audit Bureau. And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he's not in favor of that, but a number of people are making that suggestion that the Legislative Audit Bureau isn't responsive enough and therefore they want to get rid of it. Paul Domain, let's start with you on that issue.
Well, it seems to me that maybe this is just a perception, but it seems to me that this administration seems to attack certain areas. It's performs retribution and seems to be vindictive, because where people show up that they disagree with, the legislators got to get rid of it or defund it. It's occurred in this nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau. This is the agency that come up with the WEDC audit, which has criticized Walker's jobs development organization and come up with some of the policies, exposed to policies in terms of lending and everything that have led to defaults and non-collections and loans to partisan donors of Walker's campaign. It's happened with the scientists in the DNR. It happens with the university and the school system, which was predominantly Democratic voters. That just happens to be one of those perspectives. You know, it's interesting that that area is under attack. So it's unfortunate that, you know, they've decided that they're going to take a nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau, which investigates all state agencies, and gets rid of it. I mean, the message seems to kind of be like, look, it's, you know, maybe we can look the other way on some of these things. We just don't need that. I think it's a line of protection that's there for the public taxpayers.
Rick Essenberg, do we need the Legislative Audit Bureau?
Well, we may need the Legislative Audit Bureau, but you have to understand the proposal that Dave Craig is making. He's saying he doesn't think the Legislative Audit Bureau is good enough, and he wants to adopt something which I think is sort of modeled more on the federal, what they have in the federal government, and that is he wants to have inspector generals for each state agency. So, you know, the Redevelopment Commission or, you know, whatever would have a particular inspector general who would be assigned to watchdog them. And Craig is arguing that that would be really a more aggressive and proactive way to root out waste and abuse than having a single audit bureau that is responsible for investigating all agencies. His criticism of the audit bureau is that it's reactive, and it acts if somebody brings it a problem, but it's not proactive. It doesn't you know, try to, you know, sort of aggressively look for, you know, situations where funds shouldn't be abused. So I don't think the debate here is about whether there should be some type of internal watchdog. I think everybody agrees there should be. I think the debate, and the debate is among Republicans in the legislature, and it looks to me like Craig isn't going to get his way because, you know, I think this.
Well, Robin Voss basically says, I'm not interested in getting rid of the Legislative Audit Bureau, but I think he was sympathetic to the idea of maybe having some of these inspectors and instead of an either or, a both and.
Yeah, so if that's the case, it's kind of hard to argue that the focus here, that the purpose here is to somehow, you know, silence internal government watchdogs.
Let's take a call here. Joan is with us from Eau Claire. Joan, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. What a surprise. Governor wants to do away with the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau. He used WEDIC to hand out hundreds of thousands of dollars, dare I say millions, to organizations that promised jobs. Weedick did not hold these organizations to their jobs creation promises. Walker was on the Weedick board, for goodness sake. Walker likes to punish, when he gets exposed or caught, he likes to punish the people who have exposed him, or he tries to eliminate the agencies responsible for exposing his mismanagement, or dare I say corruption. Reminds me a lot of his 2010-2012 gubernatorial elections, where he had a hidden router in his office, which, of course, he denies knowledge of. Anyway, thanks for taking my call.
Joan, linking the governor to this proposal, has the governor weighed in? Rick Essenberg, has Governor Walker weighed in on the LAB discussion?
Not that I've heard.
And, Paul, have you heard that the governor weighed in on this?
No, I haven't heard that the governor's weighed in on it. But I think, I think, again, if you're talking about policy changes and directives to make the Audit Bureau more proactive, that's pretty simple. Some of these things are showing up in the budget when they're policy issues that should be discussed as separate legislation. That's one of the other hidden agendas in here, is that the budget bill was at one point filled with 100 and some pages of errors and mistakes and put together. Seems to be by at least oversight by an individual that's been out of state so often. But some of these policy issues, ought to be coming out of separate legislation. So the Audit Bureau thing is a separate piece of legislation, but I think they can get to that through simply directives and trying to tweak it so it is more proactive rather than just eliminating it.
Well, we did, by the way, reach out to Representative Craig to join us on Monday morning to talk about this during our state capitol report. He is unfortunately not available. We will discuss the plan at 7:30 on Monday morning on our state capitol report. Okay, let's jump ahead to a national, actually international issue, Fast Track. The House of Representatives in the Congress is scheduled to vote today on a plan that would allow Congress to vote yes or no to trade agreements. It's not clear right now how it's going to go down, but how would you like to see it happen, Paul?
Well, I'm sitting on the fence yet on this. I've looked at it from both directions. I think that I understand the implication that if the United States government doesn't have a trade agreement, that it might be China that does in the future, and that we need to formulate some of these things. But it's very difficult for me to support these trade agreements because of the experience that we've already had. If you look back retrospectively, the last 25 years, Wisconsin has lost a ton of its manufacturing district to overseas jobs. And so we've got to somehow equalize the playing field so that those entities in other countries are living up to certain standards having to do with pay equity, minimum wages, environmental protections, and so forth. But some of those things are written into that agreement. The question is enforceability of them. So I'm sitting on the line yet. I've got people who are in my family who both support and don't support that it's an interesting mix, that it's being pushed by Obama and the Republicans in the Senate and House for a good portion, that some of the opposition is coming from the Democrats.
Rick Essenberg, where are you on this issue?
Yeah, I'm generally in support of international trade. The thing that we don't really talk much about, because we, in the United States, we're like everybody else, we focus on what's happening to us and what's happening here. But there's been a tremendous reduction in global poverty over the last 20 years, just staggering. And it's not because of Oxfam America, and it's not because of the United Nations, and it's not because we, sent out a lot of foreign aid. It's because of economic development in countries like India and China and Korea and really across the globe. And so it seems to me that trade is a good thing, and things that facilitate trade are a good thing. I agree with about 98% of economists on that. And so, I think this is probably the right thing to do.
The State Democratic Party of Wisconsin has a new chair, Sheboygan businesswoman and community activist Martha Lanning. She picked up 53% of the vote during the party's convention last weekend. She said she promises to return to the, quote, proud progressive values that made Wisconsin great, end quote. Is that what you want to hear, Paul DeMain?
Yeah, I think she can be a strong leader. I think going into the convention, people were worried that we might not have a consensus or a or a new chair there that had a majority of vote. There had been five candidates. One dropped out with four, and so people were worried that without the runoff provisions, we might get someone with less than a majority of support. I think she can be a unifying force. As everyone knows, it's been difficult for Democrats to get what we believe is a positive message out there about some of the things we believe in, or we find that in polling that the public agrees with us, but they don't necessarily agree with how the message has been delivered. So I'm hoping that she can bring things together here in the state of Wisconsin for the Democrats.
Rick Essenberg, what do you make of the state Democratic Party's new leader? How is that going to change anything, do you think?
Well, you know, I have to be fair. Asking me who should be the chair of the Democratic Party is a little bit like asking me who should quarterback the Chicago Bears.
I realize that. You
know, the answer, is, incidentally, is Jay Cutler. since he's gone now is that, you know, Mike Tate was a pretty good guy when he wasn't between the white lines.
Okay, well, let's go to the weekend review quiz, because that's one of the highlights and why this particular show has such tremendous ratings. You can find here's today's question. You can find a museum dedicated to puppets, vacuum cleaners, mustard, you name it. Now, a couple of guys in Milwaukee are planning on adding one more quirky theme to that list. What kind of museum are they planning on opening next year in Milwaukee? What kind of museum are these guys in Milwaukee thinking of opening next year? Here's the number to call to answer our quiz, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Call and let us know what quirky kind of new museum they're planning on opening next year in Milwaukee. 800-642-1234. First correct answer gets our fabulous prize, which is so secret I don't even know what it is yet. 800-642-1234. First answer wins. What quirky museum are they planning on opening in Milwaukee next year? Okay, so let's see. What we have the prizes here. It's a WPR magnet. You don't want to miss that. Let's go to Lisa in Appleton. Hi, Lisa. What's the answer to our quiz question?
I believe they are opening a bobblehead museum.
A bobblehead museum, yes! And you win our fabulous WPR magnet. It looks great on your car. Do not take it through the car wash. Lisa and Appleton correctly identified the answer to our question is it's going to be a bobblehead museum. Wow. The National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum is going to be run by two 31-year-olds who quit their jobs within the last year. They've already collected 4,000 bobbleheads of athletes, mascots, characters, and regular and famous people. They don't have one of me yet, however. They're hoping to have about 10,000 when they open up shop and be the go-to source for anything bobblehead-related. Technically, there is a bobblehead museum at Marlins Park in Miami, but it only has 700 bobbleheads. Well, how can they even call it a museum? And they're all baseball players, mascots, and broadcasters. Rick and Paul, if you could have a bobblehead of anybody, who would it be? Rick, who would your favorite bobblehead be?
You know, I don't know, but I may be the only guy in Milwaukee that has an Ed Meese bobblehead, and
wow.
So now I know that there's some place that I can leave it when I die.
Okay, Paul Demain, what bobblehead do you want?
Well, unfortunately, I'm going to take that magnet and super glue a Walker bobblehead to the front of my car and watch it bounce all around.
Okay. Paul Demain, Rick Essenberg, thank you so much for being on the Week in Review this week. I really appreciate you spending this time with us.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend and enjoy your bobbleheads. Bobblehead Museum. Wow. Congratulations to Lisa and Appleton for winning our WPR magnet. The Week in Review was produced, as always, by Bill Martins. Judith Sears-Poisson handled on-air production. And most importantly, Bill Martins did another outstanding job of directing this hour of programming. By the way, coming up on Monday at this time, our guest, Political Science, looks at the two women in the presidential race, Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Carly Fiorina, and how their gender may affect their campaigns. That's coming up on Monday at this time. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.